My name's Devereaux, and I'm an alcoholic. And Gail said the same thing, says, you dress up nice. Devereaux, you could, I'm going to tell it. Said, you couldn't be an alcoholic. When did you, how long did you drink, Devereaux? And I had to stop and think, you know, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 years, something like that. She said, well, that's not long. That's not. And she kind of kept on. And I finally asked her, well, how long do you have to drink? She got quiet. She said, well, you just, I said, okay. Did I say I'm an alcoholic? I need to remember that I'm an alcoholic. Every day, throughout the day, I need to remember that I'm an alcoholic and what all that means. And I have this disease called alcoholism. And I had this disease, I think, long before, I probably had the disease before I wet it down, but I don't know. There's arguments on both sides about that. But I was raised in a loving family. I was the oldest of, somebody else was the oldest. I was the oldest of four children. And my parents even today admit they learned how on me. They wouldn't admit that for a long time. I kept trying to tell them. But pretty strict disciplinarians, you know, that type of thing. And then as the other children came along, naturally they got a little softer and a little softer. And then finally my baby sister, I still have resentments against her about that. She got away with everything, you know, smart back at mama. You didn't smart back at mama, not but, ooh. Even today. But as a loving family, they love their children, and they still do. And what a gift to us children. And they worked really hard and did the best they could. And I really appreciate that today, even though I didn't early on. You know, I had to work through the steps of this program to get there. Full of anger and low self-esteem and all of that. And don't misunderstand. I blame them for a long time, but I realize that I'm the problem. I'm the problem. And so anyway, I the first time I remember being fearful is when I went to the first grade. And, you know, I said, golly, look at all these kids. And teachers started asking questions or whatever. I don't remember, you know, first grade, what the heck. But some of them appeared to be kind of on the ball and smart, could maybe already do their ABCs or whatever. And, And then the fight on the playground first day or two. I said, this is going to be tough, you know, this is school business. So I learned to be the class clown. And there's one thing about the class clown. People know you, but you don't get a lot of education being the class clown. Unless you study, you know. Low self-esteem. I never felt like I fit in. And I know that. Because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and lots of little spot check inventories, big inventories, little inventories. I started drinking probably. I drank a little bit around 15 or so. I don't remember. It doesn't really matter. But around 18, by the time 18, I was probably drinking every day, because I graduated high school at 17, and then went to college, turned 18 when I went to college, and, well, I went out to college, I went out to the school, I went out there, and I went to a few classes, you know, but the English teacher, I don't know what's the problem with the teachers. They wanted me the first day to write some 500-word theme about, I don't know, some crazy subject like, what'd you do this summer? But anyway. So I didn't write, I wrote a note explaining why I couldn't tell her that. So the next week she said, Jones, I need to see you after class. I thought, oh, okay, she's going to let me pass scoop on that deal. She said, the note was too well written, Mr. Jones, which means you can do this work. So I want you to sit right there and do the work. They treat you like a dog, you know, and, you know, make you do things right there. Well, that was my MO, really, trying to get out of stuff, right? Trying to get out of work so I failed out of college, and once they get their money, they don't care. You do what you want to do, buddy. But if you don't make a certain number here, you don't get to come back next year. So I went back the next year, but I failed, and so I decided I'd go to work, and I did that, and then I had a wreck and got a deferment on the draft thing, and I was drunk when I had the wreck, but. I didn't get in too much trouble over that. I should have, but I just didn't. And so I got drafted, and in 1969, and August the 4th of 1969, I was on my way to Fort Polk, Louisiana. Oh, my God. Hot. Fort Polk. Humidity, Louisiana. Golly bum. So, and I had a drinking problem then. I knew I had a drinking problem. I was drinking too. I was drinking every day, waking up every night. I'd go to work. Here, this is what I did. I didn't drink at work. I'd go to work, hung over to beat the band. You know how it is. Ugh. Then about 10:30, 11, you go, well, and then about noon, eat a little bit. Okay, well, maybe I'm not going to do that again tonight, you know. That was rough. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do it. You know, there's about 4:30, 5 o'clock. Well, it wasn't that bad. And that's that pull bringing you back in. That disease. Wanting to feel different. Wanting to feel better. Even though I was feeling pretty good, I always wanted to feel better. And George and I were talking earlier. I didn't really drink to get drunk. I just drank to kind of get in that groove. You know, that feel-good groove. Kept overshooting, you know, because I had this problem that once I started putting it in my system, I kept putting it in my system. Rarely did I just have a few drinks. I did it on purpose a couple of times just to prove that I wasn't an alcoholic, girl. You know how that is. So anyway, I didn't drink, and you know, they let us dry out in basic training. You know, you don't drink for the first few weeks, whatever, and that was good. I needed that, went to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and I trained to be an air traffic controller, and in that school, they had us on the incentive plan, and the incentive plan was, instead of you going back to being an aircraft mechanic, and if you fail this course, you don't go back to what your job you signed up for was. You go back to infantry. Not a good plan because there's a war going on. And they said, Jones, as little as you are, you can be a tunnel rat. We need tunnel rats. I said, what's a tunnel rat? It didn't sound good. So that's where we give you a 45, your very own 45 pistol. And you go down in the tunnels and go looking for the Viet Cong. I said, what kind of plan is that? That doesn't sound good. He said, we need people to do that. I studied. They had me on the incentive plan. I passed that course. I mean. So anyway, go to Vietnam. I'm an air traffic controller. Go out to the first place they sent me was out in the boonies. I said, wait a minute. You know, what happened here? But I got to enjoy it out there. Got to learn how to drink warm beer. And you say, I'd never drink warm beer? Yes, you will. If that's all that's available, you'll drink it. And I'll never drink this particular brand or that. Yes, you will. I drank some brands of beer I never even heard of before. They had loaded, unloaded off of the helicopter, bring in the pallet, and then have sodas on there, and sodas I never even heard of, sodas, and the beer. Oh, put the beer over here, you know. So anyway, learn how to do all that. And then while I was in Vietnam, before I went, I dating this real pretty young lady, and she's smart as a whip, and she wanted to get married. So I said, no, just wait, we'll get married when I get back. No need to get, so I get killed over there, you had to mess with all. She says, well, I want to get married. I said, well, just would you wait, you know. She said, yeah, well, about 6 months in, she sent me this letter. Y'all ever heard of a Dear John letter? Dear Devereaux, remember I told you I wanted to get married? I got married. What kind of deal is that? I got drunk that night. Of course, I was going to get drunk that night anyway. I had a reason that night to get drunk. Oh, yes, yeah, son, come over here, let me buy you a drink. Oh, yeah, it's bad, you know. So I said, you know, and I got in a fight that night, and it wasn't a good day. It wasn't a good day. And so anyway, I realized I had a drinking problem, and I didn't drink I didn't have two beers the last 6 months in Vietnam. And then when I came back, I decided that, you know that term closure, you know, closure? That's some kind of buzzword, closure, you know. I decided we needed a little closure on this relationship. She got married, something's wrong here. We must have miscommunicated somehow. So I called her up and said, you know, why don't we meet and talk, you know. She said, okay. I said, oh, okay. So we met in the 7-Eleven parking lot, and we talked, you know, and she said, well, she wanted a beer. I said, you don't need it, because I knew I didn't need to drink. And so she wanted to be, you know, you women can be persistent. Go get her a beer. I didn't drink anything. So we decided we'd meet again next week and talk about it again. So we meet next week. She wanted a beer. I went and got her a beer, and I got me a beer. And that started the real downhill spiral. You know, that was about, 72, whenever it was. And I drank, naturally, wasn't long, I was drinking more than I had before. And I hung on. And I got a job offer to be an air traffic controller in Memphis. I lived in Jackson, Mississippi area. And got a job offer to move up here or there. And so I put my pillow and my lamp in the car. That's about all I had. And I moved to Memphis, scared to death. And an amazing thing happened. We had an incoming class of controller trainees. And some of them like to go have a drink after work. You know, I didn't want to act unfriendly or anything. So naturally, I fall in with that crowd. Go drink. So I begin to, so I start my career, my training and all that is 4 years of training. And, times it can be high stress. But main thing was I drank too much. Not on a job. I'd go to work, then I'd go drink. Sometimes we'd work the midnight shift. We'd go down to a little place on Lamar Avenue called the Sandwich Shop. Milton may know where that is, where it used to be. It's gone now. But anyway, we'd go there and we'd order us a ham sandwich. Of course, that was a ham's beer. You know, at when they opened at 7 o'clock in the morning. So did I ever drink in the morning? Well, yeah, but it was after I'd worked all day, all night, you know. Drank to excess. I had been dating Sarah, the lady that I've been married to for 34 years. I'm supposed to know that number. 34, 1973, when would that have been? That'd have been 37 years. So I was having, now this is really bad. You're talking about a cad. This is a cad. But anyway, I was having trouble getting up going to work. So I figured I probably need a helpmate. Well, so Sarah and I were dating. You know, we'd been dating a while, and we'd talk on the phone nearly every day and all that business. And then on the weekends, I'd commute to Jackson, Mississippi to see her. Of course, now when I got there, I usually didn't see her at first. I'd go see my buddies, but she'd still be at work usually. I tried to make it work that way, Earl. Looking back, took some inventories, and then I'd drink, and then I'd eventually go see her, you know. So I said, now I know this isn't very romantic, but this is what I did. I said, honey, on the phone, why don't we get married? And do you know the first question out of her mouth was? Not when or where or that. She said, well, what about your drinking? I didn't think that was an appropriate question. But I had a program in mind here, so I didn't want to throw things off track, you know. So what did I tell her? I'll quit. She must have said, fine. I said, fine. We said, okay, good. We went on, you know. Problem solved. I just quit. Well, I knew I wasn't going to quit drinking, and I'm thinking she knew it too. But if that's what I had to say, okay, I'll say it, whatever, you know. So we get married, and we put her lamp and her pillowcase in the car. We moved to Memphis. We didn't have. And my mother claims I had some of her towels. I might have. I don't know. But anyway, so we started our marriage and all. And I drank. We were probably married. Let's see, that was 73. All right. You know, many a time I'd get off work at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, depending on what shift it was, and be drinking at that sandwich shop with the guys or some other beer joint, and you know, time to go home. Don't worry about it, honey. I'll be there when you get there, that type of thing. And I didn't make it. And a lot of times I meant it. Not every time, I'll admit, but a lot of times I meant it. I wanted to be there because I knew I wasn't treating her right. I knew that's not the way you treat somebody, you know? Moral and philosophical convictions galore, I believe. So, you know, her story's building and building and building in her case. And I remember one time we lived in this little house. It was kind of a steep driveway deal, had a driveway. And I got there at night. It was night. It was in the wintertime. It was cold. I know it was cold because she told me it was cold. And I got my car. Well, I wanted to get up close to the steps. So instead of parking in the driveway, I parked in the yard. Knowing me, I slid in the yard, you know, driving too fast or something. But anyway, and so she heard me knocking around trying to get my keys probably, you know. And so she gets up, opens the door, and I just, boom, fall in like that. And she tells it funnier than I do, but anyway, it wasn't funny at the time, But she was so angry with me, she said, I really wanted to just leave you there. She said, but it was too cold, so I had to drag you in just far enough to close the door. And then she went back to bed. Just leave me, let him be. You know, Lord have mercy. Well, there's this guy had been working at the control center that I had heard rumors about, and he had this, he was red in the face, and I was red in the face. I looked like a thermometer, red in the face, you know. It's what the alcohol did to me. I turned red in the face, and this old boy did. And I heard he had been going to some of those meetings. I didn't even know what those meetings were, but I heard he'd been going to some. So I asked him in the break room. Break rooms, you know, we had a TV up front and in the back, about that far back, you know, you could have tables, you could eat, whatever you're doing. And I talked in a low tone of voice, which means, for those of you that don't know, talk back to me in a low tone of voice. Because I don't want other people hearing what we're talking about here. So I said, I hear you've been going to some of those meetings. And out loud, he goes, what meetings? That's the way I heard it. And those guys up front turn around and look. I want to dive under the table. And I want to choke him. I said, you know what I'm talking about, those meetings. He just grinned. He said, do you want to go to one? I said, absolutely not. He said, well, what do you want to know? And I couldn't think of a question, you know, so finally it dawned on me. I said, well, how much does it cost? He probably said, no dues or fees. But that's what I heard, it's free. I said, he lying to me. He lying. And, you know, nothing. You got to have a little money somewhere, you know, to make things. So I said, okay. He said, you want to go to me? I said, nope. And I got up and left. And boom, get out of there. So about 2 weeks later, I drank on, 2 weeks. I'm feeling really bad. Not looking good, feeling bad. I capture him in the locker room this time. He could talk as loud as he wanted to. I said, hey, man, you still going to some of those meetings? And he got this big old grin on his face. I wanted to hit him. He said, how are you feeling? I said, you know how I'm feeling. He said, oh, you feeling bad, are you? I wanted to hit him. He said, you want to go to a meeting? I said, absolutely not. He said, well, he said, I'll tell you what, said, you want to go out to Lakeside with me this afternoon to talk to a buddy of mine? I said, my God, the first time I talked to you, you want me to go to one of those dang old meetings. The second time you want me to go to a treatment center? What kind of deal is this? He goes, no, that's where the guy works, Tim B. Tim B was working out there at the time. Tim had about 2 or 3 years sobriety. But I was hurting, so we go out there and we talk to Tim, and I don't know what Tim said, but I remember, I knew by what he said and asked me that he had been where I was. I identified with another alcoholic. And so we talk on there for a little while, and Tim said, we're going to go to a meeting tonight. I knew that question was coming. I knew it was. Said, we're going to go to a meeting tonight. Do you want to go? I said, oh, I can't go. He said, why not? And I quickly looked at my watch. I said, well, it's 5:30 and my wife's expecting me home. Well, she'd been expecting me home for years, you know. He said, well, you think she's there? I said, probably. He said, well, what's your phone number? I told him my phone number. I've got a good excuse. It was 5:30. I needed a drink bad. I got a reason. Miss Jones, we have Devereaux over here. Kind of like we got little Devereaux over here. You know, we found him. We got him. Says, and we're going to go to a meeting tonight. Would that be all right with you? She must said, fine. He looked at me and he says, you can go. I didn't want to go. He said, oh yeah, she said you could go. He hung up. God Almighty. Well, I found out, she didn't tell me for many years, but I found out about 8 years later that was planned. See, he told his wife called my wife, and they said, if this happens, here's the deal. Are you agreeable to that? She must have said yes. She said, okay, we got it set up. But here's the sad part. Sarah couldn't tell me that for a long, long time because of my anger. I'd blame her. I heard that Al Anon talk today. I could hear my wife talking. It's sad. I mean, that's the truth. You know, the rage. I didn't even know what rage was, but I had it. You know, I'm really sad about that. But, and you know, I try to have a living amends today. Do I hit the mark always? No. I still mess up, you know, but I try to curb that urge to react, you know. And Philip and I were talking about that this afternoon, that try to, you know, not get too hungry or angry or lonely or tired, so that we can, when our spouse talks to us, we don't react negatively. And, you know, what an order, because, I finally believe what you people not only told me, but it was written in the literature. I'm selfish, self-centered, driven by 100 forms of fear, whatever it says, and you know, all those things, I've got it. So this old guy helped me out. We go to the Ruffet Roundup, now. They call it that for a reason, Ruffet. But anyway, I needed a drink. But anyway, you know, he babysat me. We went to a lot of meetings, and you know, thank God for it. And then, you know, but I started going to a lot of meetings. I ended up going to a meeting every day, or every night. I'd go to work, then I'd go to a meeting, because I set up my shift so I could work a noon to 8, which was really, you know, it gave me time. I should say 11:30, 7:30. I'd get off 7:30 and go straight to the meeting. And then Sarah complains, just like I heard this morning, you're not here, you're not drinking, you're still not here. That was true. But I drank to fit in, and so I had to come to these meetings to try to learn how to fit in again. You know, I didn't know that's what I was doing, but looking back, that's what it was. And you people love me, and thank God for the loving and kind fellowship we have to help bring us along until we can get involved, or at least in my case, until I could get involved in the program. We had a lot of fun. We laughed. Back in those days, we'd go to Shoney's after the meetings. I became a hot fudge cake connoisseur. I could tell whether it was a day old or 2 days old. You know, it's. They'd kick us out of. You ever been kicked out of Shoney's? I mean, my God, get these alcoholics out of here. Some of them would leave a quarter on the table. That waiter's been doing that all night long. You know. Sarah and I, we're still married, and we have 2 children, and they've never seen their daddy drink. What a blessing, you know. And I came in '77, stayed sober a year and a half, and drank again. And finally ended up in that treatment center, even though it was just to get that guy off my back. It really was. Shut up. Y'all ever felt like telling somebody just shut? Can I get an amen on that? So anyway, go to church. Let me tell you what I got out of that, though. Yes, I was able to step off the world for 28 days and all that stuff. But what I got was this guy, Jim Hayes, he was not an alcoholic. Jim Hayes gave a God talk. And he talked about, the way I remembered, he talked about three types of gods, a loving God and a punishing God. And I don't know what the other one was. It doesn't matter. But when I heard him describe the punishing God, I realized that's the type of God that I had. And of course, I was having trouble with that concept of God. And then when he described the loving God, that's the concept that I knew I would like to have. And he told in that talk, or at least the way I remember it, that it says it takes a lot of times, a lot of work. You can't just flip from a punishing to a loving God. It's a process. And I found that to be true. And so I asked to speak to him after his class, and we went back in his office and we talked for, I guess, an hour, I don't know. And then he said, I don't remember what we talked about. I really don't, but I remember this part. He's at the end, he says, well, stand up. So I said, okay, stood up. He said, okay, I'm going to hug you. I said, what for? He said, I'm going to hug you. So I'm kind of, you know, what's this guy hugging me for, you know? But anyway, he hugged me and I tightened up. And then he just tied a little tighter. And then I was able to relax and embrace him. And that was another turning point in my sobriety. You know, let some of that shell off, you know, to become teachable somewhat. And, you know, what an order for an alcoholic, because, you know, book in Bill's story, he talks about the icy intellectual mountain. Well, I had the icy mountain. I don't know how intellectual I was. But I just, you know, I guess I had learned to put those layers up to protect myself or keep from getting hurt. And because people hurt you out there if you're vulnerable. You know, they'll penetrate. And so this I started my journey, and this program gave me a way of life. I lost that job as an air traffic controller, and I went into an emotional tailspin. It's the first time I ever the thought of suicide crossed my mind. That scared me to death. I said, "My God, I just thought about killing myself. That's not funny." It scared me. I've also learned since that time and others, I can't control what comes into my mind. I mean, I get some weird thoughts sometimes. I go, "Golly, I can't believe I just thought that." They come in. Difference, what do we talk? What we do with them. You know, what we do with them. Call your sponsor. Call another alcoholic. Find an alcoholic to help. You know, I commented tonight, the ladies were helping serve the meal. You know, they may not know it, but what a gift. Because they're involved. You know, they're involved. And we used to talk about cleaning the ashtrays and washing the coffee mugs and all of that stuff. And it's to get us involved, because we won't do it. We'll stand on the outside. And think about this conference, just this conference. What a wonderful place this is. But it doesn't get put on by itself. People have to do the work. And if you've ever done any work like that, you kind of understand what they go through. And we have a convention in Memphis called the Bluff City Fellowship. And Philip and I were talking to It takes a lot of money to put that thing on. So anyway, I don't know how I got off on that, but service work. Service work, so important. And today I am, I work for, after the air traffic control job, I ended up in, as a working for a manufacturer's representative company in auto parts. And so, you know, I traveled the Southeast and, you know, sold different things. And by the way, I wasn't a salesman. May still not be a salesman, but I've been making my living doing it since 1982, you know. But I've been very fortunate. I was able to make a good living there for a few years. And we were able to put some money back and this and that. And, you know, not well off by any means, don't misunderstand me, but we had a lot of blessings. We were able to put our daughter through college. Our son went to school about 2 weeks. Where did he get that from? Oh, he's smart as a whip, but he didn't want to do the work, you know. And he's making over $100,000 a year now, so who am I to question him, you know? My children, thank God they had a wonderful mother. And Dad was okay when he wasn't all raged up and everything. And that lessened, of course, over the years. But my children now have families, and I have grandchildren. And, you know, for a guy that didn't even want children in the beginning, because I was too selfish, I wanted the Corvette. I got the Corvette. Yeah, and the Harley and all that, you know. And, I mean, I have grandchildren. They love their papa. I get called papa. You know, the life that I used to put down years ago of the guy that, you know, maybe he's a blue-collar guy and he goes to work, you know, lives in a little house with the picket fence, you know, the whole deal, and he's got the four kids and he puts them all through college and he goes to church on Wednesdays and Sundays and whatever, and he doesn't complain and he loves what he does. I used to really put that down. I said, I don't see how anybody live like that. And today, I live that, what I used to call boring life, and love it. I go to work every day. I work for myself now. I go to work every day. Well, most days. I didn't work Thursday or Friday. I came up here. Well, I work, but not a, you know. But, you know, I go to work. I've got a family. They love me. Sarah and I are still together. A lot of miracles in my life. And it's all because of this program. And it wouldn't have worked had you people not been willing to share, come together, and share your experience, strength, and hope with people like me. And Joyce and I were talking about this the other day. That, I don't want this program changed. I don't want you or me or anybody else to fix it. In fact, the more I talk about it, the older I get, the more mad I get about it. Don't fix Alcoholics Anonymous. They wrote it down. They didn't change it. What a blessing. They wrote it down. They didn't change it for 70-whatever years. Oh, a comma or two, a word maybe, but don't fix it. Keep singleness of purpose. Keep singleness of purpose. Read the long form of the third tradition. Read that occasionally. Think about anonymity on Facebook. At the public level, it talks about in our traditions. I'm up here preaching now, aren't I? Well, we're in a church. I'm standing at the pulpit. I got the tie on. But these things can break us apart. You know, I have customers that are on Facebook. You know? So when you say something like, hey, Devereaux, did you enjoy the meeting last night? Now, they probably not going to ask me, but they may. And of course, I'll give them some. I could blow through that, but I don't want to have to mess with it. Our grapevine talked about it a month or two ago. We need to hang together so that if my children or your children or my grandchildren or your grandchildren need this program, it'll be here. So we have to fight for it, really, if you think about it. We have to fight because the alcoholic's nature is to want to change it and fix it. We're guilty too. So, what a celebration this is of Alcoholics Anonymous, this small, wonderful, intimate venue we have here. Of what, 80 or 100 people, whatever it is, in this gorgeous setting on this mountain, we can come and celebrate our sobriety. Thank you very much.